Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank Peter and Michael for all the hard work that they've done. I've enjoyed watching this field for some years. And I would like to begin by telling you which of my colleagues you can go to get the real scoop on the issues that I'm talking about this morning, the ones who are here. So Michael is the world's expert on quantum noise in these crazy systems. And Yuri Rostovchev and I have been working on much of this together, in particular some recent crazy stuff that he wants to do on violating the second law of thermodynamics. That's a joke. Alexei Sokolov is even working on anthrax spores these days. And George Welch is around on many of these problems, a special friend on issues of stop and go, light and dark. Now, I'd like to try to use my 45 minutes to annoy everyone in the audience and to provide prizes for the people who get the most upset and write a paper based on any of the following seven topics. First of all, this business of photon echo, using the notion of storing, stopping, and time reversing light via photon echo. I'll, in each instance, specify the details of what I mean by these points. I'd like to take my cue from this list of topics, and as I present each of the topics, hope that you will help me to clarify the issue, and at the end of this time, hopefully get through questions like freezing light, by the way, freezing versus stopping. Stopping means storing. Freezing means holding it there, as in not moving. Superphase conjugation. Superphase conjugation in the sense that will be defined later, and excited state coherence as opposed to ground state, dark states. Photon master equation, squeezing of slow light in fibers, fast cars, anthrax detectors, fast standing for femtosecond adaptive spectroscopic technique, and of course, coherent anti-Stokes Raman spectroscopy. And then finally, computer simulations and real experiments having to do with quantum thermodynamics and quantum coherence. Stop a minute. We all know these days that you can break emission absorption detailed balance. That's how we make lasers work without population inversion. If you can break detailed balance, you can break the second law, the first law, whatever law of thermodynamics you might like to play with. Maybe, maybe not. I'd like to convince you that in fact you can produce a Carnot engine operating with super Carnot efficiency. Now if you've taught thermodynamics in the last 5 years, you realize that this is tantamount to heresy, right? So I'm a stationary target, I've written it down. And if you agree with this, great. And if you don't agree with it, talk to Yuri. Here's the skinny, $1,000 cash prize for a paper, in fact, for the best paper, on any one of these topics. And also, you will have an invited paper at Texas Atomic and Molecular University and at Physics of Quantum Electronics Snowbird Conference, January 5 to 9. This year and or next year. Bob Boyd and I will be giving you more details on that. And you will get a 72-ounce Texas T-bone steak. And as I said, the prize committee is a committee consisting of Peter, Michael, and myself. And in case of simultaneous submissions and ties, well, you know, maybe we'll give two prizes. Yes, I have them all written and ready to go. Now, let me go with each of these topics in turn and try to say something which kind of puts in perspective what it is that I'm trying to emphasize and why it is that I would like to see a paper, even a review article, written on these subjects. In particular, let's start with the second, namely stopping light via hot atoms. This fissure of letter actually used the word freezing light, stopping light in the sense that Michael was using it as a polariton issue, storing the blueprint of a photon state is a perfectly reasonable use of the word. After all, if you put a photon in, absorb it, store it, throw it away, and then later you get a photon out which is a carbon copy of that photon, it is the same photon. So I have no quarrel with the use of the word stopping. On the other hand, if you can really stop, freeze in the sense that a car comes to a stop sign and stops and then goes again, while it's still a car, all right, not a blueprint of a car, then that's somehow different. In particular, this paper, which by the way was not so much slow light as slow fissure of letters. It went in 99, it came out in 2001. And here's the score. If you have an index of refraction, which is a function of both K and omega, that is to say, if the polarization is as in the red box, then the group velocity is defined not just as a 1 over dN d omega group index piece, but actually has this extra piece up top, which you see is indicated. So, you know, what we tell our students and we tell ourselves is that V group is equal to C over 1 plus N group, where this is d N d omega omega. Now, in addition to that piece, in addition to that most important and usual contribution, and recognizing, of course, that N is just one, is the same as the susceptibility modulo factors of 2 or square root or whatever, there is another term, very interesting term up top, which is a term that subtracts from the speed of light so that the group velocity is the effective group velocity minus something else, okay? V group minus Vs. Now, this is interesting and in some sense physically understandable and obvious as well if you think of it in this way, namely that if I have a static cell, let's see, what do I want to look at? If I have a static cell and I have photodetectors at each point and the pulse goes in and a little bit of scattered sidelight somehow is detected by each of these detectors in turn, then I will see, of course, triggering 1, 2, and 3. But if the cell is moving, then it will always be the first detector that triggers a photon up to a certain time, and then nobody sees any light because the medium moves on out and the game is over. So several important points. First of all, it's a strictly super simple configuration in which I have in mind a piece of glass or gas moving with some velocity. And I am trying now just in a super naive way to think in terms of what I see in the lab frame. So I don't think anybody's going to argue with that. And it only lasts for a certain finite period of time, okay? So I'm not stopping the light forever. And that's something we should come back to. Now, what if I had flowing gas? Again, that's something that we could liken unto a moving cell. And we would always be, perhaps, for some configuration, seeing counts in the first detector. And now, let's think of a situation in which we burn a hole. And I'd really like to pump all the atoms into some state and only then have these atoms moved into a configuration such that they interact, okay? Let me say it differently. Imagine that I have all the atoms pumped into some magnetic sublevel such that they're not in the game. And then I come in with a laser pulse traveling in some direction and I excite only some velocity subgroup. So it's the Babinet inverse, so to speak, of what I've drawn here. However you do it, it's then quite reasonable to think perhaps that you could stop light by using a thermal Doppler distribution of atoms. So ironically, it may be the case that you can actually do something interesting vis-a-vis slowing down light with hot atoms that you couldn't do if you had ultra-cold atoms in a mock. So that's kind of amusing. But what I would like to ask then is that you focus with me on this question. Can we freeze light via spectral hole burning? And by that I mean, just as I said, that we somehow, within the context of this paper and this picture, think in terms of a situation in which this minus k dN dK term counts. Okay, so that's the second issue. And the question of spectral duration, etc., is all something that I regard as very interesting. I would love to hear debate on. And as I was saying earlier, if I didn't say it, I should have said it, I will take the opposite position to any position that any of you want to take on these important problems. Okay? If there's something I really want to learn, then I will argue either side. And so if you push me, I will argue that you have to have indeed zero energy content when you stop the pulse. Because, hey, look, you've absorbed all the light except what's right there at one tiny frequency interval. On the other hand, I will also argue that there is a sense in which we're stopping only for a finite time, and therefore there's a finite delta omega, et cetera, et cetera. And I really would like to see these things clarified, and that's point two. Point one, moving on.
Yeah.
Say it again?
What exactly do you mean by freezing versus stopping?
I mean what I was putting on this view graph here, that I only see counts in some particular detector. So I have in mind a situation in which a light pulse comes in, and it actually is interacting with the medium, perhaps quite weakly, but it interacts and occasionally spontaneous emission photons come out. So that if I can arrange that some detector, say this one, is the only detector after a while that's seeing any counts, then I'll call that frozen. And it'll only be frozen for some time. And perhaps when it's really stopped, maybe nobody's home. Nevertheless, there is this sense in which there's a limiting case of actual stopping of light using hot atoms. That's what I'd like to argue and clarify.
So
okay, so if I'm putting light into a medium and I store the quantum state in the ground configuration, rho bc, then I really can stop that light, store it there forever, and hold it. Okay, and so that's really, I would call that really, in some sense, the blueprint of the photon.
The hologram, if you like.
Exactly, precisely.
Which you can lead out later.
Yeah.
Separate readout beam, but here
your
light
is always there. Yeah. That's the thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
got it. Thank you. But the number of photons you have inside is now just the ratio of the medium velocity to the vector speed of light, as opposed to the input photons, right? So you have some light
reaction for this
reflection.
I'm sorry?
I don't agree with that. I mean, this is based on your analysis that you change, say, the group velocity as a function of time. But what you're doing, you're putting it in a moving medium. And so the energy content is, if you subtract for the kinetic energy associated, is the same as before.
No, this is already true for the light medium. The number of photons inside the electromagnetic potential. I'm not talking about the medium, but the electromagnetic.
I rest my case. I rest my case. Here we have the experts arguing, and I feel, again, I can argue either side, and I'm happy to. But I think that both sides are viable. I can make this argument that I made for Ray, and I can also understand and appreciate what you're saying. But I think that there is a subtle a sense in which I really can argue that the light has stopped and there is some radiation around within some region, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd love to read your paper on the subject. Moving right along, let me come to the next. Michael talked about photon echo and cast dispersions and made nasty comments about people who do photon echo trying to claim that they've stored the state of light. All right. Anti-echo.
Which is superluminal in the sense that it comes out before the photons arrive. And don't laugh, I think Dan Gauthier has actually seen it in the experiments that he showed last week.
Oh, John's at Berkeley, right? It figures.
No. Gauthier.
Oh, at Duke.
At Duke.
Oh, I would expect better from him. Oh, fascinating. Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't hear it. But seriously, I would love to...
I'll tell you about it.
Yeah, well, I love it. I mean, you know, you'd be a prime candidate for prize number one. Let's go to prize number one. And since this is a... Now, I want to watch my time because I definitely want to get through to the last part of this, which is the business of using quantum coherence to say something interesting about the second law. So now let me... when did we start? About 5 after?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Let me just now... come to this business of time reversing and transporting light via atomic coherence. And this is an idea which is based on, stimulated by the work of Michael and Lucan and others in their theoretical paper, and then the work of Lucan and others in Cambridge. Ron, were you involved in that? Yeah, that was your experiment you're the guy who did the experiment, right?
Yeah.
Good. So that seminal experiment leads one to think in terms of a modest change in which you say, well, what if I now send in the two pulses which constitute the original storing of information on the grating? Okay, and then I had a view graph here in which I tried to summarize. Okay, may I start with this? So in all of these fascinating ideas, we can write a phenomenological Hamiltonian in which we have a weak field and a strong field. We're thinking in terms of a ground state coherence. And the electric field associated with the readout, restored pulse, is something which is generated by the stored quantum information and the incident readout field. Okay, well, this is just saying what you all know very well, but the point is that you could read out in the opposite direction to what you stored at the input. And that is this, in the sense that the original two pulses, which prepared the ground state coherence, the quantum blueprint, if you will, are then now probed by a intense pulse, capital E2, and then the restored pulse, which is a quantum state, and therefore gives us back the state of the original input photon, but going in the opposite direction. So this is really very much like holography, real-time holography, phase conjugation. And that's fun. Why not? And has, in addition to this ingredient of writing and reading quantum mechanically, so the time-reversed pulse has been defined and the experiment carried out. Let me now, keeping an eye on the clock, simply point out that there is now a diffusion of the excitation. If I think in terms of atoms being excited in some region of space-time, as indicated up here, this little cloud, we read and prepare the atoms into a ground state superposition here, and then we wait, and some of the atoms diffuse away, and now we read out in this case, no need to go in the opposite direction. We send in a reed pulse and get out the reproduction, the restored pulse. So that if you're completely overlapped, that's what this is. This is the reproduction pulse. And if you're displaced by some amount, you have a weaker but still very substantial signal associated with the quantum field. And here you see it in which the incident writing pulse is here, the outcoming pulse right on top of it. And now if you displace, as indicated over here, you see that you have lost intensity, but still it's still very discernible. Now, that leads me to ask my question, how close is this to a Raman echo? And I remind myself in your presence that the first Raman echo was carried out by Gershon at Bell Labs and someone else. And back in 76, using semiconductor systems and spin coherence. So there's a lot of history here and a lot of physics that's of interest to people in today's laboratory situation. And of course, what they were doing is preparing the ground state coherence by effectively a pi over 2 pulse, then flipping it with the next combination of Raman pulses. So this is just as if I were somehow coming in with a microwave field and preparing the coherence and then flipping it, and then finally read out in the third step by sending in a pulse and looking for the echo. Okay, now what I would like to understand better is the extent to which it is possible or impossible to do this at the quantum level. Certainly in their experiment, and in any experiment that I can think of right now, the fields are all classical. But in principle, I see no reason why we couldn't store the information, the rho BC information, and then look off at the angle theta and see the prepared quantum state. And this is perhaps consistent with what we were discussing earlier, but maybe it's a little different. Maybe it's exactly opposite. I'm not sure. What do you think?
Well, I can only say that the only ecosystem that I have seen which principally works on a single photon level that means with 100% efficiency is the one by the layer first.
Okay. So this is a question that I'd like to understand better, and I see no in principle reason why it couldn't be done. So that's the definition of problem here listed as one. Time reversing light via photon echo. And by the way, photon echo is another example of real-time holography, except that it's real-time holography at 2 theta. Okay, so now, superphase conjugation and coherent state excitation. Now I'd like to get a little bit technical, and since everybody here is an expert in this business, I think I don't have to apologize for that, but simply say, interested in the question of weak ground state coherence probed by a strong field in the sense of Phil Hemmer, of Lucan, others, such that we're really doing double lambda configuration. Please to note that in the typical discussion of such a problem, we are thinking of the basic physics as being contained in the ground state coherence, rho BC. So that if I have a dark state, rho BC will be determined by strictly the Rabi frequencies on the two red transitions, let's say. But if I now have a detuned field coming in, weak detuned field indicated by the green lines, then I must calculate the polarization, which is defined as rho A2, say. So that's rho B A2. 2 goes with A, all right? So these kinds of density matrix elements will always go into the Maxwell equations and generate the associated fields, rho 2. Indicated here by the Rabi frequency omega 2b, okay, and so forth. But here we're giving special emphasis on rho bc, and rightly so, because in all of our experiments, rho bc is all that survives. The other interesting coherence, the excited state coherence between A1 and A2, is missing because we have rapid decay out of the excited states on on nanosecond timescale. So if you look at the physical content of the rho bc terms, then you find that it's driven by populations. N1b means Na, the number of atoms in the one state minus the number of atoms in the b state. Okay, so these terms are just population-driven terms, and these terms are now extra terms. If I had a small coherence here, it may be that I can come back into the game and generate interesting contributions not only to the relevant polarization directly, but it also feeds back into rho bc, which in many cases is all that counts. So there is then, in this sense, a very real issue going with the calculation of the coherence terms, rho bc, and the fact that under certain circumstances, like rare earth atoms, so praseodymium 3 plus, excited state coherence could last, say, 10 to the minus 4 seconds, and we could talk Phil Hemmer into doing an experiment in which the coherence up here could be important. Then it wouldn't be just rho bc, but would be other terms that we have to take into account. And I think there's some potential gold there, and I would like to see a paper on that subject. And that's the point 3. So superphase conjugation and excited state coherence, as opposed to, say, super-Raman physics, in which the real physics is almost always going to be the ground state. One last word.
I don't understand the title. Why do you call it superphase conjugation?
Fair enough. Why do I call it superphase conjugation? Because it's phase conjugation at the single photon level. It's phase conjugation in the sense of Hemmer, in which the grating that I'm scattering off of is a rho bc grating. And it is a super strong transfer of field from, say, E2 to omega 1 into E2. So say it this way, please. In comes field E1, mixes with little signal E2, and now I read out with big field E2, and I get E1. But I get a fantastic efficiency as compared to ordinary phase conjugation because of all the usual resonant enhancement non-absorption character of the problem. Period. End of paragraph. New paragraph. But in addition to what we typically think of as being the physics, namely for the wonderful Raman experiments of Hakuta, Sokoloff, Harris, you, and everybody, in which I have maximal coherence, we now have minimal coherence. We now have very small ground state coherence, rho bc. And since that ground state coherence is so small, what should I show? Let me go back to my main view graph. Since this ground state coherence is so teeny-weeny in superphase conjugation, then the excited state, rho 1-2, has a chance to come in and play an equally important role. So that's my PhysRev letter of the summer, I wish. I'd love to work on that problem, but I cannot. And I therefore would love to read a paper on the subject. Thank you for the question. Next question. Issue of the line width of the four-wave mixing mirrorless phase conjugator, okay? So parametric oscillators, I have a view graph here somewhere, parametric oscillators based on such phase conjugate gratings, coherence gratings, were discussed by people in antiquity, and I think Bob has papers on that. Certainly Steve Harris has papers on the subject. And you can think of it as being essentially a distributed feedback kind of configuration. And so you're going to be, under certain conditions, able to actually oscillate on the weak fields here, given the two strong fields in. Okay? Question, what's the line width of that oscillator? If you don't know the answer, would be, I'm sure, surprised to learn that the line width is extremely narrow, governed by the group transit time through the sample. And this is surprising, since, of course, we typically think of the shallow town's line width as governing such a situation. And somewhere as I paw through here, I'm going to find the right view graph. Here it is. Well, you're the world's expert on parametric oscillators, okay? Is it? I don't think it's the same, because it's more of a parametric oscillator, isn't it? In which I have now generated an oscillating steady state field by transferring energy from one field into another. So it isn't just a backward wave oscillator as I think of it in terms of free electron laser kind of scheme.
It's a backward wave oscillator in terms of Brillouin scattering.
Right, but here I'm thinking of it as being more like phase conjugation.
Oh.
So I send in two strong fields and I get out two other fields.
Uh-huh.
And so in that sense it's not quite like backward wave oscillator, it's more like parametric oscillation. Okay?
I think it is like a backward wave.
Do you?
When you have a gain in stability, things grow exponentially.
Right, right.
When you have a backward oscillator, it's an absolute instability.
It's a global instability. It's like the simulated Brillouin instability, isn't it?
It's like infinite gain in four-way fixed phase conjugation.
Okay.
I would call that an example of backward wave oscillation.
Okay, the reason I was saying it wasn't is that I think of backward wave oscillation as being essentially the free electron laser, right?
I think that's an example.
That's an example. But look at what's happening there. I have light coming in here. I have the beam, electron beam coming here. And now, effectively, I have another light beam. So I have three things going on. And here I have not three, but four. So it's four-wave mixing. And isn't that then a little bit different? That's what I was thinking.
No, because, for example, simulated Brillouin scattering has three-wave mixing. You know, a forward laser, a backward sound wave, and
okay.
Backward, right, and forward sound wave, but you still have phase conjugation.
Okay, so you would call that backward wave oscillator, and I stand corrected. Thank you. But here's the point that I... Here's the point that I think is fascinating, namely that, as I'll get to in a moment, the actual line width of the radiation is governed by tau group. Okay, so delta omega phase conjugate oscillator is equal to modulo factors of 4, 1 over tau group divided by the average number of thermal photons. Hey, that's exactly what we see in a laser. Delta omega laser goes like the lifetime of the photon to the minus 1, gamma, nu over Q of the cavity, divided by the average number of photons in the cavity. But in this case, of course, when we have something that's on the order of a couple of centimeters, and we're moving at 10 meters per second, then the lifetime, effective lifetime, is much longer than it is for a laser in which gamma is perhaps 10 to the minus 6. There's no reason that this couldn't be 10 to the minus 1. So it's interesting. And here's the score. How do we calculate such things? Well, remember, please, what you know from the laser. You write down some quantum equations, and if you like to do it in a Heisenberg picture. You write the quantum Langevin source, and at the end of the day, written here in terms of power, you end up with this line width, okay, where gamma is nu over q of the cavity. Same thing when you're calculating the line width for the phase conjugate oscillator. You do the same kind of calculation, and you write down, following Michael and his wonderful facility with this stuff, you write down the Langevin equations, do the calculation, get that answer. Hey, I'd like to submit that I don't really understand this stuff until I can do it on the back of an envelope in the shower. And I can, okay? I can if you'll give me a photon master equation analysis. Why so? Remember what Townes did in the old days. They said, hey, well, there are two equations. There's the equation for the average number of photons in the cavity. So for the laser, average number of photons is equal to some gain times n bar plus 1, stimulated spontaneous emission, minus loss, n bar. Okay? And this you get from the master equation for the photons. The electric field, E, expectation value, is just going like alpha minus gamma times E, right? If we're at steady state, this is equal to zero. So alpha minus gamma is equal from here, alpha minus gamma is equal to alpha over n bar. So here we have, and in fact minus, here we have the Shallow-Townes result, gain divided by n bar. Right? Well, I'd like to see a similar kind of analysis for the phase conjugate oscillator, but I really don't know how to do it, and I'm sure that it would have some interesting connection with the laser physics, but it would be different. So you can probably do it this afternoon and make yourself a cool $1,000. Fast cars, anthrax detectors. How's my time, Mr. Chairman? What have I got left?
Officially about 15, 20.
Okay, good. So let me then just switch over to the next topic and simply introduce, slow light and fibers. I'm going to skip that and let somebody ask me a question, perhaps. Here's a theorist's picture of anthrax. Actually, fascinating. Endospores generate a kind of living crystal in which all the DNA and protein is packed in dipicolinic acid, a simple molecule. This molecule is something that sucks the water out of the protein, out of the vicinity of the DNA, and allows the endospore to live in a hibernation kind of sense for many years, like 25 million years. They found endospores in amber and put it in a nutrient, and it begins to reproduce and regenerate. So here's the interesting point. If you look at the Raman spectra of dipicolinic acid, pick some particular bond, that one, then you find that there's some strong Raman resonance. So at 1,000 wave numbers, dipicolinic acid, there you are. If you look at two different kinds of endospores, say anthrax and some other endospore, you get the same signature. And so what you'd like to do is enhance that Raman signature by using the kinds of CARS techniques that our friends now have made wonderful use of in hydrogen and other systems. And in particular, we would like to think in terms of preparing maximal coherence by, for example, fractional stirrup or a chirp pulse configuration. Now, it typically takes, since the chirp pulse, slow down, remind myself, has to be an adiabatic kind of a preparation, it typically takes Rabi angles of about 50 in order to prepare ground state coherence between B and C. Okay? or thinking in terms of stirrup, same thing. Thermally, there's no excitation in state B under the conditions that we're talking about. I come in with a stirrup pulse, and of course I would transfer everything from C to B. But fractional stirrup is such that I shut off one pulse before I go completely through the adiabatic passage game, and with a fairly large pulse here, we're able to populate coherently the Rho BC ground state. Now you come in, scatter off that, and you enhance the signature in this kind of problem. And what you would like to do then is to do this in conjunction with a learning algorithm and perhaps not end up with a chirp pulse or a fractional stirrup at all, but with something else. And that's what we're interested in studying. And one way to do that, and something that I am hoping we do more of shortly, is via computer simulations. Okay? So a paper has been written and will appear shortly. Alexei knows about this problem, and I would be delighted to show you what we're doing, and very pleased if someone has some thoughts on the subject. Finally, let me finish with this issue of how can I use quantum coherence to say something interesting about thermodynamics. And I have copies of the paper here, half a dozen or so, and I'll get more if people are interested. Here's the score. Let's start off with a single mode radiation field in a micromaser cavity, a la Herbert Walter, and let's ask, what is the equation of state of that single mode field? Interesting answer. PV, which is equal to KT for a single atom, turns out to be H bar omega times N bar, where N bar is the usual Planck factor. Okay? In atomic pumping of this piston, you can put any amount of energy into the atom, but you only have one atom. So this is equal to KT. For the right. So I have in mind just a simple single mode problem in which there's one mode of the radiation field only. And if I go to multi-modes, then I'm back into Stefan Boltzmann limits, okay? So let's stick with one mode, and let's then note that under those conditions, this is the equation of state. By the way, I'd like to know if anybody has seen that before. I ask Gordon Bain if he'd seen it, and he said no, he hadn't seen it, and it was wrong. And that was good news, right? But please to note that in the high temperature limit, N bar goes as KT over H bar omega. So this goes to the atomic limit in the high temperature limit. This goes to just KT in the high temperature limit. Okay, so that's fair. And have you ever seen PV equals KT for Nyquist? Yeah, I mean, it's easy to prove this, and I'm just curious to know if people say, oh yeah, that's in Cattell's book on thermophysics, okay. And anyway, this is just the starting point. And now given that starting point, here's how we build a heat engine. Let's do this. Let's start off regaining ordinary thermodynamics by imagining atoms that circulate through the engine and push the piston first isothermally, then adiabatically, then we compress isothermally and adiabatically. So we have the Carnot cycle. Now let me slow down to make sure I'm making myself clear, right? Okay, so I have in mind atoms which are prepared in a thermal superposition of A and B, Boltzmann superposition. The atoms are resonant with the field, and they go through the cavity, and they contribute some energy to the radiation field. Now, radiation pressure then pushes, so the TS diagram, I start at point one with the piston all the way in, and the radiation pressure pushes it out, and we do that isothermally, out to point two. Now I quit putting atoms in, and the piston coasts on some further distance adiabatically. So entropy change is zero, come down to point three. Now I hook up the radiation cavity to a lower temperature reservoir at T cold. Oh, please denote that the atoms are now always in equilibrium when I send them in with the whole realm, which is at T hot. Okay? So the upper leg is at T hot, and now I compress isothermally to point four in connection with this thermal reservoir. Then I take the thermal reservoir away and complete the cycle. Calculate in a few lines the efficiency, and it turns out to be just the Carnot efficiency. And as Carnot taught us 200 years ago, the interesting thing is that it doesn't matter what you do, the only thing you have to play with are the temperatures of the two reservoirs. Good. Now comes the joke. What if we use three-level atoms, and what if we prepare these atoms in a coherent superposition of the B and C levels? And so again, we have in mind that atoms come out of the engine, go through the whole realm. They're now prepared in passing through this whole realm in a thermal distribution of A, B, and C. They come around, now go through a microwave field, which generates a little bit, actually very tiny, coherence between B and C. Why do I say very tiny? Because if this is a hot reservoir, you'll have essentially equal populations in B and C. Now you shine microwaves on it, you don't get much coherence. Rho BC is very small, but it's finite. Now you come out of the cavity, out of the microwave cavity, and insert these atoms, which are in the configuration such that it's mostly thermal, but there's a little bit of off-diagonality, and you find that the new efficiency, the new Carnot efficiency, defined as the ratio of conversion of heat here in the whole realm to work into the engine, is the official dyed-in-the-wool Carnot efficiency times some new factor, which depends on rho BC magnitude and the phase of the microwave field which governs this thing, phi. So now we have a new parameter, phi. And in particular, if phi is taken to be equal to pi, then let me call that temperature T sub pi. And oh, by the way, that's a real temperature. Okay? It isn't an effective temperature. It's really the temperature as defined by the thermal radiation field existing in this cavity, prepared now by atoms which went through in precisely the spirit that we were talking about here, but now with this tiny amount of ground state coherence. So this coherent superposition of ground states prepares this kind of TS, prepares the radiation field, and we have this kind of TS diagram. So everything is the same, except that T hot now equals T cold, and the temperature is T cold plus this extra little bit. Omega over C, it's not obvious, but I can show you in a few lines that all this stuff here, the 3, where am I? 3 times the average number of thermal photons times rho BC is, for all intents and purposes, just omega, the frequency between the two lower levels, the ratio of that to capital omega, the optical frequency. Okay, so this might be, this ratio might be, say, 10 to the minus 2. So 1% then of the energy in the cold bath is transferred into work. Well, you say, gee, that sounds like a violation of the second law. Not yet. Because what you must look at is the energy that it takes to prepare the coherence, and it's interestingly large. Calculate the network defined as the area in this TS diagram, and it turns out to be in terms of the effective Carnot efficiency defined here, okay? The microwave energy is 10 times that amount, and the whole realm energy that we've transferred to the atom is 100 times W net. So I don't like the way I've written that. Let me write, it's in the paper, but W net, the network, under the conditions that phi equals pi, is equal to essentially the quantity we call Qn times omega over capital Omega. That's the effective efficiency here, okay? So that the A to C maybe should have an A to C super pi. Stop. Is that interesting? Yeah, it interests me, and I could tell you why a lot of people are interested. Some love it, some hate it. But in all of these cases, these three problems, we are striking against the dogmas of physics, as the Süddeutsche Zeitung wrote when we had the first laser without inversion, you remember. And that's what we should always be doing, at least for part of the time. And I'd like to propose then that there are many ways in which quantum coherence can impact and extend what we typically think of as thermodynamic wisdom. And next week, I'm going to San Diego, where there's a conference on quantum thermodynamics, and I'll tell you how that goes, but I'm not the only one who's saying such things. If you read PhysRev letters of last week, there are papers which I brought here having titles like this: Experimental Demonstration of Violation of the Second Law of Thermodynamics for Small Systems in Short Times. Okay? And I would love to defend my premise, if you give me a chance, and point out that Norman Ramsey did this already in 1954 with the introduction of the concept of negative temperatures. So it's not as kooky as it sounds, but it's just kooky enough to get into PhysRev letters. Thank you for your attention. The actual piston-driven cavity.
No, I mean your microwave, which prepares the ground state coherent.
The microwave cavity is driven by a microwave klystron. Okay, it's not driven by a thermal source, but the cavity itself is at room temperature. But the energy that I have to take from the wall plug, putting into the microwave cavity, turns out to be 10 times the amount of work that I can actually get out of my engine. So I do not have a perpetual mobile of the second kind.
So that means in your whole cycle, you have a non-thermal equilibrium element.
In the sense...
Consider all elements to be thermal.
Absolutely. In the sense that my atomic density matrix has tiny off-diagonal elements, it's out of thermal equilibrium. But please to note that if you characterize the temperature in this sense by anything like a reasonable definition, the temperature isn't changed, because the diagonal elements go like, the change in the diagonal elements of the ground states go like the square of rho bc. Rho bc itself is a small number, like 10 to minus 2. So the actual change in the temperature is very small. So it isn't the change in temperature that counts. It's these tiny catalytic, atomic ratchet-like off-diagonal elements in the sense of Feynman, that we now have atoms which want to emit and don't want to absorb light.
Okay, I hope you don't mind, Marlon.
Yeah.
Give a little reveal of what happened last week. There are what I call conceptual tensions between the three fields of temperature that are represented by three circles. Okay.
Hey, why don't you take this?
Thank you.
Let's put it up over here. I'm fascinated by this quantum thermodynamics problem because of something I said last week, which is to remind those of you who weren't here, that at the beginning of the 21st century, as I see it, there are three pillars of physics, which I represent by three circles, representing three conceptual domains. And I labeled the first one by H-bar, that's quantum mechanics, and the second by two constants, the speed of light and Newton's constants, representing special and general relativities, and then, of course, KBT, which is thermodynamics and statistical mechanics. And I was focusing on a conceptual tension in this region here between quantum mechanics and relativity, especially general relativity, where there are a lot of conceptual tensions, for example, between the equivalence principle and the uncertainty principle. To just give one example, another one is entangled states versus separability in general relativity. But what you're focusing on is now this one, which is very interesting also, between quantum mechanics and thermodynamics. And the heart of the tension, as I see it, is between reversibility and irreversibility, as I see it. Okay, but we should talk about this. The reason I'm bringing this up is because there is a paper, which is not very well known, by Elitzur, who points out that the whole issue of superluminality that we've been covering last week is related to thermodynamics, and that really what is fundamentally going on when we say nothing can go faster than the speed of light is that if we were able to do that, then we would be able to violate the second law of thermodynamics. I refer you to this paper, which is in Physics Letters A sometime in the 90s. I'll give you the reference later on. No, letters. It's not Phys Rev. Physics Letters A. Okay. And basically, it's something about superluminal effects and the second law of thermodynamics. Okay, so basically, there is a connection between these tensions that exist at a very fundamental level conceptually between the various fields of physics that we know and love. Okay, so I'd like to just point out to you that this example, which is beautiful, of a thermal Carnot cycle, which seems to violate second law, it's quite closely related to the conceptual issues which Elitzur pointed out between these two fields. Okay, and well, anyways, these conceptual tensions are related to each other quite closely. That's what the only remark I wanted to say.
Well, this might be irrelevant, but you start out with your original PV equals whatever at zero temperature, you would have PV equals 1/2 H bar omega, which is ignoring the Casimir effect because there would actually be an inward pressure, at, you know, which would dominate at least a small separation. So just make that little remark.
Yeah, good point.
The Casimir effect, of course, is an attraction. This is a repulsion. And furthermore, we haven't taken into account what's going on the outside of the piston, which is, okay, so the issue of the 1/2 is a question which I haven't really discussed, but I put it there just so people would ask the question. And at least one of my co-authors hates the 1/2 because he maintains it's not physical. But it comes into the Hamiltonian by writing it in a reasonable way, and I promised him that I would ask you about that.
So what are you saying, Peter? Are you saying that the Casimir effect reverses the sign in what the Marmon has been saying?
At zero temperature, I believe so, because you have an attraction instead of a repulsion.
I see.
But it may not be relevant when you find a temperature. Yeah, that's what he said.
But they're always there, right?
But to follow up on Reeve's point, the cross-section there with H bar KB is typically what you call decoherence. Or in other words,
yes.
I mean, mm-hmm. partially irreversible process.
Yeah.
Another couple of interesting historical points based on Ray's observation. Eddington, the great pioneer
in C and G made the observation in the famous statement that if your theory violates the second law of thermodynamics, there's nothing for you but to collapse in disgrace.
And he said this, I don't know, what, 1940, maybe? Or maybe he said it in 1960, but he's wrong. It only takes one counterexample to disprove a theorem, right? And Norman Ramsey published a paper in 1954 in which he showed that if you have negative temperature, then the famous Kelvin-Planck statement of the second law has to be extended. Remember what they said. Kelvin-Planck say that you can take any amount of work and turn it into heat, boring a cannon, but you can't do the opposite. Norman Ramsey points out that if you have a negative temperature, all the atoms are upstairs, then you can turn any amount of heat into work, like with a maser. He wrote this before the maser, by the way. Any amount of heat into work, but you can't do the opposite. So here's a case in which at least this statement of the second law, which appears in all the textbooks, has to be expanded when you include quantum mechanics, two-level systems, negative temperatures. All right? So we know that we have to think more carefully, perhaps, than would have been the case before we had H-bar in the game. But personally, I think we'll find at the end of the day that there is still no perpetual mobile of the second kind, but now you have different kinds of extensions, a la Ramsey. Maybe phazonium is a hotter fuel than rocket fuel. And I better stop right there. Thank you for your attention.
For the newcomers,